Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This, in salute to our fine University of Kentucky Wildcat basketball team, this is the Final Four show. Of course, we are recording this show the previous week.
We're live. Well, no, we're always live.
Well, then it should be the National Championship show. I don't know, but we are uncertain. We decided to name it the Final Four show.
I wished it was the Crystal Ball show, because I'd like to know who's going to win.
Yep, we do not at the time the show is. You do. You have the advantage on us today. Special thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio and from the University of Kentucky. A man, you can take him off the radio, but you can't take the radio out of him, at least not without general anesthesia. A man to explain our web presence, University of Kentucky telecommunications guru, Rick Phillips. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tony. You know you can get the audio of the show at WMKY.org. That's right, WMKY.org. Just do a little search, find the Health Matters website. You'll find all the shows, or at least most of the recent shows listed. There'll be a summary there. There'll be a way to get to the audio and listen to the show. There's a link there where you can sign up for a podcast. If you know what a podcast is, then you'll know exactly what to do. So, audio of the shows, WMKY.org. Then jump on over to Facebook.com on the web, do a search for HM Radio Show, or just put a little slash, a forward slash, as we say in the business, on the front of that, with HM Radio Show, and you will find a fan page devoted to Health Matters. There we'll post some news, some research, sometimes it's stuff on the show, sometimes it's stuff that's just relevant at the time. We certainly welcome your feedback. We welcome show suggestions. We welcome just about anything. We just want to know you actually know how to type facebook.com/HM Radio Show.
Our sponsor for today's show, Veggies and Fruit. That's right. If you want to be both edgy and cute, remember to eat your veggies and fruit.
In now, 11 years, you've not used this one.
I know, because there has been a flurry of very interesting research
What's funny?
Vegetables and fruits.
Neither of those terms describe either one of us.
Well, I'm working on it. And
neither one of us have edges.
Oh, we're not edgy.
We're rounded.
Certainly not cute.
We're rounded. what you would refer to as rounded.
I got you on that. However, even well-rounded individuals like us can improve our life expectancy and our quality of life by eating veggies and fruit. Now, here's what I'm doing, Rick. When you talk about it, you usually say, eat your fruit and veggies.
No, I usually say just have fruit.
Okay, that's your problem. Now, this was published in the Journal of Epidemiology and Community Health back the end of March. This was from the Health Surveys for England. Researchers looked at 65,000 adults over age 35 who participated in these surveys between 2001 and 2008. And in the survey, they asked them, how much fruit and vegetables have you eaten over the past 24 hours? And then they compared that nutritional information. They followed them again for 7 years and looked to see who died and who didn't die. First of all, as far as the survey goes, they ate an average of 3.8 servings of fruit and vegetables per day combined. Older non-smoking women ate more fruits and vegetables than others, and the ones who ate more fruit and vegetables tended to have a lower body mass index, a lower weight. During the 8-year follow-up, 7% of these people died. If you compare with the people who ate less than one serving of fruits and vegetables a day, those who ate 1 to 3 had a 12% reduction in all-cause mortality. As you went up, more servings of vegetables increased your risk reduction. If you ate 7 or more servings a day, 33% reduced risk of dying.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you need protein to go along with that? I mean, or is that, were these vegetarians?
No, they were not vegetarians. They just asked them, tell us how much of this food, that food, the other food you ate. And these people ate a lot of vegetables. Now, maybe this was because these people were sick. Well, they actually excluded people who died the first year, and the numbers were even more striking. If you eat 7 daily servings of fruit and vegetables, 42% lower risk of dying, and lower risk of dying of cancer, lower risk of dying of heart disease, lower risk of all-cause mortality. Vegetables and salad, the best protective effect. As a matter of fact, all fruits did not lower your risk of dying. Now, when they separated out fresh fruit or dried fruit, that did lower your risk. But if you ate canned fruit, or certainly if you drank fruit juices, your risk of dying went up slightly.
Heavy in the sugar?
Yeah, that's the thought. Maybe it is the sugar that is the issue. As a matter of fact, it really gets pretty interesting. We've got an editorial that helps us to explain this in our second fractional portion. Now, In addition, Rick, there was a paper presented at the American College of Cardiology's session, again, the end of March. Women who ate 9 to 10 servings of fruit and vegetables in their 20s were 40% less likely to have dangerous plaques in their arteries by their 40s. The men, it didn't work out for. The women had lower rates of plaques in their arteries. Now, it may be, again, they're talking about fruits and vegetables, and by the way they define fruits, they may actually be diluting out the effects. But it looks like vegetables are the key thing. Eat more vegetables. So again, if you want to be both edgy and cute, remember to eat your veggies and your fruit vegetables, the key to a long and happy life. That is our sponsor. Well, I think winters may be over.
I think the quicker we move off of edgy and cute will be better.
Okay. I think I'm moving on.
You think
on.
Winter's over? You think it's actually over? Well, it is April, so, I mean, usually we get one snow in April, don't we?
Yeah, it's just a nuisance type snow. You know, it's a, what well, is it snowing
all
in April for?
Snow is nuisance type snow, Tony.
Well, here's the problem, as if we didn't have enough to worry about. The fact that none of the trees, none of the bushes, none of the plants started in March because they were busy fighting for their lives and trying to avoid freezing to death. Now, they are all in sync starting at the same time. Allergy experts are expecting a particularly bad allergy season because, again, we have a sudden warming of temperature and all the plants start at once. As a matter of fact, if you have not at this point started your allergy medications and you have regular spring allergies, experts said you should have started them over a week ago because we're going to have a very heavy pollen season. Kind of discouraging. You know, I think, first of all, one of the nurses that works with me in the Sherry Building rides horses, does a lot of horseback riding in the wood, has already pulled ticks off of her.
Okay.
In March. My wife also, we were out walking in the fields and she picked up a couple of ticks as well. So that whole myth that a cold winter will in some way affect the mosquitoes, the ticks, and so forth, appears to be wrong. This is as early as I have ever seen ticks bit in by the people.
It seems to me, Tony, that you need the ticks to come out because they think it's warm, and then, uh-oh, it turns back cold again. That's what needs it. We need a good cold spell. Then those ticks, they're gone, right?
No.
Okay, what do they do? Go back and hibernate again?
You know, I just really, honestly, I don't think that you can alter the conditions. I know that ticks like moisture. Once it gets really hot and dry, that starts to have an effect on them. Also, we know that you can modify the environment, rake up the leaves, mow the grass short so that they don't have a place to hide from the sun. They don't like that sort of thing. I think other than that, I think that whole temperature thing is just wrong.
Okay.
I think it I do
All
not
right.
think
That's
that you
your
can
opinion.
Fail. Yeah, so you're hoping for a cold snap.
You be the edge, I'll be the cute.
I'm just saying, why would you want a cold snap? I mean, I'm happy to put winter behind me, but we've got a whole new set of problems. Now we got allergies, now we got ticks, and we got to worry about those, but those are summer-type things.
Okay.
I put this next article in just for you.
Great.
I want to point that out. This is Dr. Costas is his name. He's the John Detweiler Professor of Cardiology at the Cardiovascular Institute at Rutgers Robert Wood Johnson Medical School in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And he is talking about some research that he has done. He looked at trials of the statins. These are those cholesterol medicines
right.
that have had a remarkable effect on our risk of developing heart disease or dying of heart disease. He looked at 11 trials that compared the effect of statin treatment, and he looked specifically within those trials, they had some men who had erectile dysfunction, ED, in the trial. Some of them got statins and some of them didn't. If you look over all these 11 studies of these different statin medications, you wound up with 647 men with ED. Average age was 58 years old. Now, if those men were on a statin medicine for an average of 4 months, the level of erectile function increased about 3 times. That is, they could have 3 times as much satisfying sexual activity after being on a statin as the people who didn't get the statins
okay.
in these studies. Now, this is not as good as, say, Viagra or the other erectile dysfunction drugs, but it's pretty darn good.
Did the statin just give their body a chance to become a little more healthy? Is that what it was? Or
yeah. Well, there's several ideas.
Blood flow? Or?
Maybe there's a better blood flow. Maybe it regenerates the lining of the blood vessels in the diaper area. Maybe it helps with nitrous oxide, which is, there are several effects it could be, but he reminds us, this is why I put this in. This is what Dr. Costas, the principal investigator, says. Erectile dysfunction is like the canary in the coal mine.
One of my favorite comments.
Yes.
Except not about ED.
Yeah, yeah. But it's the canary in the coal mine, and so I'm reminded of Rick's floppy canary.
No, I just
comments.
Said when the canary flops over, you're in
yeah,
trouble.
You're in trouble. And so that was Rick's comments on erectile dysfunction a few shows ago. You go back and take a look on the website. You can find this. But the point is, and we've said this over and over again, erectile dysfunction is a problem with your circulation.
Right.
It is not just a bad luck. It is not something that you try to just to cover over you. I can take something and then I can go have sex the way I want to. But rather, consider this a serious thing. It is sort of like failing a treadmill test. It is like having a pain in your chest. It is a sign that you don't have the circulation you need to function normally.
So, Tony, if you go to a physician with an ED problem and they prescribe you Viagra, are they going to even try to fix the underlying problem these days?
Well, I think you have to insist on that. That is, if you had some surgery or an accident or something like that and are having problems after that, well then, okay, I understand that. But if you are very happy in your relationship, but you are, as you get older, struggling with this, it's time to get checked. And really, the checkup should focus on your cardiovascular health. This is, again, as he said, the canary in the coal mine. This is something that is your warning sign that all is not right with your circulation.
Usually, we don't talk much about this topic because, well, quite frankly, with your edginess and my cuteness, this thing can go way off the rails.
Yep.
But, you know, the fact is, for years, this was a problem that was an indicator of bigger problems. And somehow or another, we chose to fix it on the surface, so to speak.
Yeah.
You know, we swept the rest of it under the rug.
We used to not have anything. We called it impotency. That was
right.
What it was. We were impotent. And then we developed some drugs, and now it becomes erectile dysfunction, or we go with ED to go along with our low T.
Well, ED is something you can say in public.
Yep. And you can feel pretty manly about it. I mean, you're in the bathtub there, or you got the gray hair, but the woman is putting her head on her shoulder.
I never understood the two tubs.
Yeah.
I mean, if you fix the ED, you only need the one tub.
I have several answers.
See what
answers.
I'm saying?
Edgy,
I know,
but,
cute.
Yeah, but
see what I'm saying? That's
definitely edgy because I have several answers to that, none of which I really think should be on the
I'm
radio.
I'm just saying this thing can run off the rails, and I'm not letting you start this next thing. Now, you can tease it.
I will set it up. Let me just say that we're recording this the week of April Fool's Day. And when I first found out that the British National Health Service might be advising pizza and Italian restaurants on how to prepare their foods, I thought, this has got to be April Fool's. I actually pushed this aside because I thought it was an April Fool's joke. Turns out it was not an April Fool's joke. The original story broke on March 31st, and we have the information here. Would you allow your government to tell your pizza place what to do? We'll bring you more in our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. Additional information on the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center is available at 606-783-6506 or online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Final Four show. Our salute to the victorious University of Kentucky basketball team. Victorious up to the point that we recorded this show. A lot of mystery in it. You know, we don't. What happened after that?
And no, this isn't to be mistaken with our Final Four shows.
Yeah, we're not going off the air. You're going to have to contribute a lot more money to Morehead State Public Radio than that to get us off the air. We're very stubborn that way. Our sponsor for the second time, Veggies and Fruit. If you want to be both edgy and cute, remember to eat your veggies and fruit. This was the Health Surveys of England study. 65,000 adults over age 35 followed for 8 years. Those who ate the most vegetables, 7 servings or more daily, about somewhere around a third risk reduction depending on how you broke it down. Reduced risk of dying from cancer, reduced risk of dying from heart disease. Interestingly enough, they did not see an overall benefit from fruits. When they teased out fresh fruits and dried fruits, there was a survival benefit. But looking at canned fruits and particularly at fruit juices, actually a slight reduction in people who ate more servings of those.
Well, yeah, I mean, those are more processed, if you will. I mean, they've probably had stuff added to them, preservatives and sugars.
Right. Last week of March, American College of Cardiology session, American physician also looking at women who ate 8 to 9 servings of fruit and vegetables in their 20s. They were 40% less likely to have dangerous plaque in their 40s. That's 1,600 women in the study, somewhere between 3 and 8 servings of fruit a day, whereas men, there were 1,000 men in the analysis, no difference for men. Again, we are starting to wonder if maybe you cannot say fruits and vegetables. Vegetables seem to be a much better source of nutrition, and the life-saving benefits, whatever they are, seem to be better from vegetables. Now, there was an editorial with the British study. This is from the University of Liverpool, and I want to point out some things that they said. First of all, what we know. Mortality is decreased more by each additional portion of vegetables consumed than by each portion of fruit. Second, a diet rich in vegetables is protective against cancer, heart disease, and total mortality. The problem is, at least in England, and I think also in Kentucky, only about a quarter of the adult population has adopted a healthy diet. And the healthy diet was five portions a day. But again, they saw a continued benefit in these two studies going up to seven portions a day or more. Third, there's no maximum. And then they wondered if maybe the five-a-day campaign may offer some false reassurance. That is, it's good to eat vegetables. Your job is to eat as much vegetables as you can, in my mind. And they mentioned the very thing that Rick said. This was from, again, Journal of Epidemiology and Public Health. They said, might refined sugars be the problem? We know there appears to be a causal link between sugar consumption and heart disease. Sugar not only makes you overweight, but there is something else about sugar. If you got overweight from eating other things, you have a different path than if you eat large amounts of sugar. One can of sugary drink, regardless of weight, increases your heart attack risk by about a third, one can a day, and that was a U.S. study. Fresh and dried fruit consumption does reduce death from all causes in this most recent study, but fruit in composites, fruit in cans, fruit in juice, not associated with or maybe even increases all-cause mortality. So this guidance currently suggests that dried canned fruit, fruit smoothies, fruit juice, we are currently counting those toward our fruit and vegetable servings.
Oops.
But we probably shouldn't.
Right.
We probably shouldn't.
I mean, how does that not make sense?
Yeah.
You know, when it comes down to putting the man-made spin on things, I think the fruits and vegetables were kind of meant to be had as nature intended them.
Yeah, I think so.
Off the tree or the plant or whatever, out of the ground, whatever it is.
So the most conservative approach to this is push those vegetables and minimize certainly the fruit juices, which have way too much sugar in them. But it may be that all fruits, we're still uncertain about fruits overall, but vegetables came in pretty solid in both of these studies as an excellent way to extend your life expectancy and also to enjoy things more. Now, it may be, you know, that people, they try to control for diseases, socioeconomic status, and so forth, but it may be there is something about people who eat vegetables. They may hike more, they may wear flannel, all sorts of things. But
I mean, do you honestly think you'd meet a person who has routinely every day seven portions of fruits and vegetables every day that is not somewhat health conscious?
Yeah, I think.
I mean, so it just seems to me like, you know, you can't order seven fruits or vegetables in a drive-thru.
Right. And, you know, it's frustrating not knowing, but let's face it, you cannot order people to eat or not eat a certain food for 30 years and see
Absolutely.
What happens.
Right.
So all we can do is observe people as they do what they do and try to figure it out.
And how many people are like, I can't speak for you, but for me, where I go through phases of those 30 years where a year and a half of it I'll eat healthy.
Right.
And then next thing you know, I'm off the wagon or in between wagons. with some chocolate cake.
Yeah. No, I understand what you mean. I mean, circumstances change. Your job situation changes. I've said several times, I used to exercise during lunch. Then I got a new job, and all of a sudden, I had lunchtime meetings almost every day.
Well, yeah.
It does change your schedules.
I started a job where all of a sudden, I have every day I'm 2 hours in the car. It's just, it took me a long time to realize you shouldn't eat and drive.
Yep. That's absolutely
true. That's a tough one because it just goes, I mean, it's the worst way to eat.
That's our sponsor, Veggies and Fruit. Remember, veggies, the key to a long and happy life. Now, we talked last time about the British Health Service.
Yep, we teased it. And unlike other shows, when we tease, you get it.
This is about the public health responsibility deal. Now, that sounds
boring.
This would never play in the United States. This is the United Kingdom. It's called the Public Health Responsibility Deal.
An agreement.
Yes. Local businesses may choose to sign up to the National Public Health Responsibility Deal as local partners. Now, here's the benefits. Here's what you get for signing up to the Public Health Responsibility Deal in the United Kingdom. One, a certificate and a letter from the Secretary of State for Health.
Nice.
You had me at certificate.
Checkmate.
Yes. Promotion through the National Responsibility Deal website.
Add-on. Whew. That's just a bonus.
And then an opportunity to network with other organizations at the Responsibility to Deal network events.
I would
run
pay
into
money for that.
Like-minded Responsibility Deal people. Now, what is the Responsibility Deal? Here's the five tenets.
So what is the deal?
Of the public health responsibility. I know you think, what's the deal with this? Number one, we recognize, and this is businesses, restaurants, and so forth, we recognize we have a vital role to play improving public health. Two, we will encourage and enable people to adopt a healthier diet. 3, we will foster a culture of responsible drinking, which will help people drink within guidelines. 4, we will encourage and assist people to become more physically active. 5, we will actively support our workforce to lead healthier lives. So it is the public health responsibility deal means that we as business people are going to dedicate our business to improving the health of our customers.
So we're going to sell treadmills.
No. Now, in the case of restaurants, they have some principles for restaurants. 1, we will provide calorie information for food and non-alcoholic drink for our customers.
Okay.
2, we will commit to the salt targets. They're very big on salt restriction in England. These salt targets are a responsibility deal special, 15% reduction from the 2010 targets, and we will give total salt reduction of nearly 1 gram per person per day compared to 2007. So they're really trying to ratchet down their salt.
Apparently, we're a race that's addicted to salt.
Yep. 3rd, we do not use ingredients that contain artificial trans fats. So, interestingly enough, we in the freedom-loving United States just ban it.
Right.
We just ban it. We say, oh, you can't have fat. They said, well, let's responsibility
moderation.
Deal pledge not to use trans fats. 4, we support and enable our customers to eat and drink fewer calories through actions such as product menu information and reformulate our market mix toward lower calorie options. Now, that's the key thing. So, in order to lower the portion size, these are your tips for Italian restaurants from the British Department of Health. Department of Health actually has, and you're supposed to achieve at least 10 tips before your next responsibility deal audit. Every year you tell what you did. So here's tip number 1 for Italian restaurants. Reduce your pizza size by an inch.
Okay. Sounds easy.
The government is telling pizza places to reduce your pizza size by an inch. You sign the responsibility deal.
So people will just order 2.
Yeah. And it says, the government tells you, you will save money by using less dough and fewer toppings. 1, that's pretty obvious.
Right.
But 2, now the British National Department of Health is trying to help your restaurant save money.
Correct.
Yeah. 2, consider reducing portion sizes across your menu. This will also save you money by reducing the ingredients you need. Obvious, again, odd that the government
doesn't it
do
to
this.
Some extent that unless you lower your prices, aren't people going to think you did a bait and switch or some kind of a there's deception there?
Well, but they have said, you know, you will save money. They've not said you will be able to lower your prices. So the idea is, and this is how it got to my attention, there was people that wrote in and said, look, what they're saying is, why don't you charge your customers the same amount for less
right.
product? And that's what the Department of Health says. Item 4, if you make your own pizza dough and tomato sauce, gradually cut down on the amount of salt you use. You can do this little by little over time so your customers won't notice. And then also remove the salt shakers from tables and only give them to customers on request. So these are some of the things that they mention for Italian restaurants. And these are health tips, but the government getting involved in the size of the pizzas is, you know, this is, again, we looked at this in New York with our size of sodas, and we said not to be done.
Well, but I mean, they really haven't done anything about the size of sodas, right?
No,
we
rejected
that. You can still buy a gallon of soda in a to-go cup to drink going down the road.
Yeah, because New York, where that was tried first, rejected it.
Yeah, so, I mean, what makes them think for a second, Tony, that they can, you know, obviously this is done in the UK, right? This partnership deal is not here. So maybe it has a chance of succeeding because Europe, I think, has kind of proven to be a little more healthy than we have.
And they've got their responsibility deal. You know, you sign the responsibility deal and get all those certificates and benefits.
Well, maybe the bigger question is who signed it? Has a bunch of them signed it?
They have. You can get a list of their partners who have signed on to this. And it's sort of like, you know, if you're an American person, you go, okay, here's a list of places to avoid because apparently they're going to cut back on their ingredients and the size of their pizza. Here, just a couple of things from the Department of Health sandwich tips for restaurants that serve sandwiches.
Nice.
1, this is tip number 6 here. If a customer asks for a spread on the sandwich, try to spread it thinly. And there's a little money bag beside that, so it tells you. You don't have to, they don't say this saves you money. They put a money bag beside it so you know.
Some places put little healthy indicators. They put little cash.
Money bags.
Cash,
yeah. This cash is from the the Department of Health. And number 8, if you mix 2 fillings, you don't have to use a full portion of each one. Try using a little less. Tip number 9, cheese. Use grated cheese instead of sliced. You can use less cheese, and your sandwich looks like it has more volume. And so,
do you like grated cheese on your hamburger?
Well, you know, I
mean, have you ever tried to eat it? It like falls all out. I mean, it's terrible.
Well, but I mean, they can use less. I mean, you can see you could get a half an inch of cheese, and it wouldn't be as much as in a slice.
True, but, you know, like I think actually here, I believe it's Rafferty's down in Lexington has I think it's a barbecue burger, but the cheese they put on it is grated. And so now I know what they're doing.
Yep.
But really, I mean, it was – I ordered it one time a long time ago, and it was impossible to eat without, like, a fork. I mean, just because it all falls apart.
Well, you know, fundamentally, this is just an
opinion.
And believe
me, I'm experienced in eating, Tony.
I understand. Fundamentally, I think people in the United States do not trust our government. And it's not a matter of Republicans not trusting Democrats. Just in general, we would not trust our government to advise restaurants on how to reduce their portion sizes. And we've shown this.
Well, wouldn't it be – where would the irony be, Tony, if we were to fill out this – have the government push it out, but yet we can't get any kind of a federal mandate on smoking. Well, I mean, you could go smoke in the restaurant, but boy, you couldn't get a big pizza.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. Frankly, the problem I've always had, the smoking bans in my mind, a person who smokes is, in fact, having a direct effect on their neighbor. Now, you can argue that now that we are all required to purchase insurance and our insurance rates are geographic and not dependent upon the diseases we have, frankly, I have to pay the same rate as a person who has is massively obese or eats an entire pizza or something like that.
But ultimately, aren't I subsidizing that?
Yeah, that's the point. So when do I care about your eating? If you smoke and the smoke comes over here, I care about that right away. If you eat too much and you wind up blowing all my insurance dollars, I should care about that enough to do something about it, but I won't. I mean, and this is all voluntary. This is the responsibility to deal. The restaurants sign a pledge. You know, we come at you with laws that say you cannot have a large soda in New York. They didn't pass, but that's our response. We would never have restaurants sign a government-sponsored responsibility deal. Just would not work.
Right. I mean, yeah. This is kind of a tough thing because, you know, the intent is good. The goals are good. It's how and when, all of the circumstances surrounding it, it just can't be perceived well. And there'll be a natural suspicion that'll creep in. And there'll be people who will suggest that it's profit mongering. And it really doesn't have anything to do about health. It's really just a way to maximize profits. I mean, there'll be all kinds of things. Because, again, in the end, if you're sitting there eating a 1-inch smaller pizza and the person next to you is smoking, I mean, what have you really prevented?
Right. And speaking of trusting the government, this is from March 31st, 2014. The CDC reported this. Measles, once thought to be eradicated in the U.S., we would have maybe 60 cases a year, almost all of them originating from outside the United States. In 2011, there were 222 individuals, most of them actually Americans who were not from outside the country, in one of the largest measles outbreaks in the last 20 years. Last year, we did drop down to 159 cases, but we are off and running this year. As of March 28th, 49 cases of measles in California, 21 cases in Orange County alone. One-third of those were hospitalized. Generally, about 1 in 5 people with measles has some type of serious complication. 21 cases in New York City as of March. 10 cases in children, almost all too young to be vaccinated, but they picked them up from other older children. CDC says worldwide, on average, 430 children die every day from measles and its complications, most of those because, ironically, they can't get the vaccine that we take for granted and refuse to get.
Wow.
This is a very contagious disease. If one person has it, 9 out of 10 people close to that person, not necessarily touching that person, not necessarily sneezed on, 9 out of 10 people who breathe the same air in the same room will also become infected unless they are vaccinated.
That is extremely contagious.
Yes. And that's what happens. We have these outbreaks. We have had what we call herd immunity. There are enough people in that room vaccinated that they will not transmit it. However, we don't get vaccinated anymore.
Right.
There are large numbers of people who've decided that measles vaccine is not in the best interest of their child. Again, not trusting our government. If we cannot tell them about life-threatening diseases that we almost had eradicated and now are slipping away from us, we're certainly not going to get them to sign a public health responsibility deal and have smaller pizzas. Just a reminder to all of us, doctors recommend first dose of MMR, measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, 12 and 15 months, second dose usually before you enter kindergarten. Please, please, if you are sitting on the fence on this, this is absolutely critical you get your child vaccinated. 1 in 5 who gets measles has complication. 9 out of 10 who are in the same room as a person with measles will, in fact, come down with measles unless they are vaccinated. And we are seeing outbreaks every year now of 3, 4, 5 times the levels we had back in 2000 because our vaccination status is deteriorating. It's very, very discouraging.
I'm probably pretty sure I was vaccinated You know what? I think I ended up just got them.
Yep.
I think most of us just got them, right?
Yeah. And now there's a better option, but what do you do?
But is there a chance you can get them again? I mean, I guess there's always a chance you could, even if you've had them, you could have them again later if it was a mild case. But typically, you don't do that, right?
Right, right. The immunity to measles is actually pretty good. You know, we've talked about chickenpox and shingles, but measles itself, once it's over, the problem is it's a really nasty disease while you got it.
Right.
And the complications.
It's again, a lot of scarring, and yeah, it's just.
And,
yeah.
And things more serious things like encephalitis, or, again, 18 children. Around the world, 18 children every hour die from measles and complications.
So
we have a vaccine which will almost in all cases prevent it. We just simply don't use it.
What are we going to talk about in this next fractional portion?
This is great. The question is, if you are anxious, if you're calm, if you're married, if you're not, are you going to die?
Yes.
Well, are you going to die? Are you going to live for a long time? That's the question. We'll answer that question. Well, we won't answer, but we'll at least talk about it in our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. Additional information on the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center is available at 606-783-6506 or online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is our final four show, our salute to University of Kentucky Wildcat basketball team.
Who we don't know how they did, but
that's
we
great.
Are hoping.
Who really rewrote their story of their season in the NCAA tournament. We're very proud of them.
I mean, Tony, we don't really try to hide that, you know, obviously the show is recorded a few days in advance. Quite a few. So I think I mentioned to you on the way over to the show today, I'm leaving tomorrow to go to Dallas. I'm going to actually try to root them on.
Okay.
I may actually jinx them, but you know what?
No, wait. You're leaving to go to North Texas.
No. It's actually Arlington. It is so deceiving. It is not, you know, this. I don't know why they say the North Texas Final Four. I mean, I'm sure they're trying to promote.
There's politics there.
But it is absolutely, positively southwest of Dallas in Arlington. I mean, it's really more due west. You know, it's right between Fort Worth and Dallas.
Right.
But I'm very, very interested in seeing the AT&T Stadium. There's just something, as a video guy, you can imagine, I kind of have grassroots in video and video conferencing. There's something amazing about going to see a video screen that cost more to build than the original Cowboy Stadium. I'm excited about seeing a video screen that big. I mean, it's pretty sad that I'm going to go to a game to watch TV.
Right. So Rick is headed to North Texas to support the Bluegrass area sports type team.
Absolutely.
In their endeavors in a
great big blue and white.
Yeah, something or other. So we'll be very vague ourselves about that. Our sponsor for the final time, Veggies and Fruits. If you want to be both edgy and cute, remember to eat your veggies and fruit. Veggies, the key to a long and happy life. Reminding you of the Health Surveys for England study, 65,000 adults over age 35, 8-year follow-up. Those who ate more vegetables had a dramatically lower risk of dying. Again, 1 to 3 portions reduce the chance of death from any cause by 14%.
Dying early.
1 to 3 portions reduced chance of death from any cause by 14% over the 8 years of the study. 3 to 5, 29% reduction. 5 to 7, dropped chances by 36%. 7 or more portions of vegetables, 42% decline. Fruits, not so clear. Again, the problem was they mixed fruits, fruit juices, canned fruits, and fruits as a component of other things. It was the way the study was worded. They didn't have any options, but it was an interesting footnote there that the fruits did not have the effects the vegetables did. So, mortality decreased more by addition of vegetables to your diet than fruit. Secondly, protective against cancer mortality, heart disease mortality, and total mortality. Third, benefits keep increasing. We've gone up to 7 a day in England. In the U.S. study, 9 a day and still saw additional benefits. And fourth, and this is the big question, are the added sugars, are the sugars that are used to store, to make fruit juice, are those the culprit? Does that, in fact, cancel out the effects of fruit? We don't know. It's an observational study. You have to just ask those questions. But certainly this study tells us that we should be pushing vegetables, and there does not appear to be an upper limit. 3, 5, 7 servings continually show an increase in your chances of staying alive, not dropping dead of a heart attack or cancer.
But you know, Tony, you know, just as we've talked about processed fruits and, you know, processed vegetables, there are also vegetables that are better than others. And I know just from the years I spent messing around with Atkins diets or low-carb diets, you learn, you know, I'm a big fan of corn. I really like corn. I really like carrots. I like green beans, all three of which I figured out after reading a little are very high in sugar. You know, they have a higher sugar content than, say, broccoli or asparagus or something.
Isn't it great that even within a healthy food, you and I both can root out the ones that have the sugar in it?
Absolutely.
Because those are the ones we like.
Exactly. I mean, so it was weird. I mean, you know, I'm cursed with a sweet tooth, genetic sweet tooth, as I like to call it, you know, because it runs rampant in my family. It's one of those things where I was able to, after reading the book, going, yeah, okay, yeah, now it makes sense because of the vegetables I like the most are the ones that are laced with, you know, natural sugars.
Corn and peas, so, for me.
Exactly. Well, peas
and,
is another one.
Yeah, and corn, keep in mind, Gene says over and over again, corn is a grain. Corn has that vegetable type look to it. It's
right.
Grown in a vegetable garden, but we're not allowed to call corn a vegetable.
Well,
sadly enough.
Yeah, but she's not here.
That's right. Corn's a vegetable, by golly. It's a really sweet one. Put a little butter and salt on it. I'm all over that.
But I just think it'd be interesting, and where I was going with that, Tony, was I think it would be interesting to see this study broken down by, you know, as they ruled out processed fruits and fruits that were higher in sugar or had some kind of, I think it'd be interesting to see a vegetable breakdown of, you know, if you move away from the more sugary vegetables or the more complex, I guess that's what it would be, complex carbohydrates.
Yeah.
As you got more of those out of the vegetable category, would the benefits go up even more?
Right. In England, they actually can study ordinary people. The problem is we've had several results coming out of the health professional follow-up study, which is basically doctors, veterinarians,
right,
dentists, or the nurses study. And let's face it, I know for a fact doctors and nurses are not normal people.
Right.
Yeah, so that's the problem with some of the U.S. studies. They may or may not be applicable to the general population. This was, in fact, the general population they studied. All right, so we talked some about the health benefits, I think, of anxiety, of relaxation, of reassurance, and I'm going to give you three articles. In the time we have left, we're going to try to get through three articles that I think have an impact on that, and we'll try to at least discuss them. The first one actually was published March 19th in the British Medical Journal. And this, again, was United Kingdom. We seem to be doing a lot of UK stuff here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Primary care practices between 2011 and 2012, they looked at 16 million prescriptions in the United Kingdom for sleeping pills. They call them hypnotics, which are sleeping pills, and anxiolytics, medicines you take for anxiety. Benzodiazepines, this is Valium, Librium, Restoril, drugs like that, two-thirds. And the Z drugs, that is the Ambien, the Lunesta, and Sonata, they were about one-third. They found 34,000 patients from 273 practices, all older than age 15, all prescribed either a benzodiazepine, a Valium, Librium, or one of these sleeping pills, Lunesta, Sonata, Ambien. And then they compared those for every person who took the drug. They found the records of two people who didn't. So this, we call it case control study. That's the way they do it. And what they found was the ratio, the risk of dying, was about three times as high if you were on one of those drugs as a person who had similar age, similar diseases, and was not taking sleeping pills or anxiety medicines. Now, and this, by the way, this included the benzodiazepines were the worst. Restoril was the one they used a lot in England. But we saw similar effects for Lunesta, Ambien, and Sonata as we did for Valium and Restoril. There was a problem. Now, there's two things that I think immediately, Rick, on this. One, we've made this point over and over again. Whatever sleeping pills do, they do not make you sleep. They render you unconscious. But whatever you are doing there, it's not sleep.
Right.
So that's one thing. These
sure
medicines,
feels like it, though.
Yeah. These medicines could have that effect, which is bad. The other thing I think is, no matter what disease you have or risk factor you have, if you are so unsettled that you need medicinal help to manage your anxiety or to get to sleep at night, you are a higher risk person. So it may have nothing to do with the medicines themselves, but people who find they need those medicines to cope with the illness they have.
Continuously.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we're not talking about having an episode or needing it, you know, once in your life for a few days.
Right.
We're talking about habitual or chronic use.
Yeah.
Right?
Four times the death rate if you receive more than 90 doses in 1 year.
Gotcha.
Of the drugs. So that's three months out of the year.
That's a third of the year almost.
Right. So the drugs, I'm not fond of the drugs at all, but this study doesn't tell me if the drugs are causing the problem or if the need for the drugs is a sign of a person who is not doing well and, in fact, has a higher risk of dying. But for whatever reason, if you're going to be anxious about anything, be anxious about your anxiety medicine. Isn't that weird?
Yep.
Yep. But I think you should.
Really? But wouldn't it be better if you weren't real anxious about anything?
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be more healthy?
Yeah,
at that point, you wouldn't have to eat as many fruits.
Well, and if your pathway to being calm includes taking pills, you know, there are so many ways that you can become calm. Develop a hobby, be around other people, meditate, perhaps take up a religion, become more spiritual. There are a lot of ways to become calm other than medications, but they do take time. I just read, and I didn't bring it to this show, where young people are perfectly willing to accept the fact that they might need help of a mental professional, but what they don't want to do is to sit down and talk about it.
Right.
What they say is, look, I have a problem with anxiety, I have a problem with depression, I need medication.
Text me.
Yeah. Well, yeah, give me an app and give me a pill.
Right.
But
actually, in that order.
Even as the acceptance of mental illness goes up, the willingness to actually sit down and have a counselor talk with you is dropping.
Right.
Among younger people.
Right.
So the problem is we take these shortcuts, and every time we take a shortcut, it appears to be a bad decision. Mm. Next, and this would be a good one, the risk of cardiovascular disease. This was presented during the American College of Cardiology's 2014 session in Washington back in March 28th. They did a survey of 3.5 million Americans over 20,000 sites. So the numbers in this thing were huge. And they looked at whether they were married, widowed, single, divorced, 2/3 married, 13% widowed, 8% single, 9% divorced. And they looked at their rates of stroke, their rates of heart disease, their rates of, they call it PAD, disease of the other arteries of the body. Married people.
Is that peripheral artery disease?
Peripheral artery disease or PAD. PAD was actually the big one. People who were married had a 20% lower rate of PAD. They had about a 2% to 3% lower rate of coronary artery disease and stroke. So it appears that being married does confer benefit. However,
for which one of us?
That's a good question.
Because, I mean, we've always talked about on this show over the years is how the men get way more advantage in a marriage than a woman.
Well, regardless of your sex, if you are divorced or widowed, your risk goes up rather rapidly. So if you can tolerate being married. Now, there are a couple of things about this. They had a quote from Dr. Vera Bittner of University of Alabama, Birmingham, said this points out we cannot measure heart disease risk purely based on laboratory tests. The psychosocial variables can be very important. And she talks about managing hostility, stress, and getting social support. My problem is, do you think that you can say categorically that people who are married have less hostility and stress? I'm not sure that's so.
Yeah, it didn't sound right.
You know, I mean, that's in an ideal world, yes, that's why you get married, that's why you stay married, but I'm not sure you can just say that, well, the reason that they have a lower risk. I think, for one thing, if you have a spouse who, I'll just say this, if you have a spouse that nags you, you may be more compliant with taking medications than if you're out on your own. They may bring you back to a more responsible position by the fact that you are living with another person. That might be so. But I'm not sure that being married necessarily reduces your level of stress. And we know for women,
would you like a shovel?
It's not.
Because you're digging a hole.
Okay. Do you think I just ought to get off this one then? Right
well,
now?
I mean, I think, you know, yeah, well, yeah, let's move on.
Okay. So let's summarize what we've talked about so far. If you are anxious and take medication for anxiety, this British study says you have a higher risk of dying. If you are married.
If.
You are married, you have a lower rate of cardiovascular disease, particularly peripheral vascular disease, than those who are not married. And the wonder of marriage is something that Rick and I have no words for and no explanation for.
It's the most wonderful thing.
It is, and no explanation whatsoever.
What's next?
The next one, and this is where it gets a little strange, okay? Several years ago, and we may have even brought it to this show, there was one study of Botox injections in 10 patients, and they shot them with Botox right in the forehead.
Oh, man. That sounds not fun.
That's what you do, you know, because you've got those wrinkles in your forehead. So they shoot you right over your nose. They call it the glabellar area, and they give you Botox, and that's supposed to relax your face. It turned out, in one pilot study, 9 out of 10 depressed people had improvement in their depression after a Botox injection. So up comes Michelle McGidd, who's an associate professor of psychiatry at the University of Texas Southwestern and happens to be married to a Dr. Reichenberg, who is a dermatologist. So you have a psychiatrist married to a dermatologist. Guess what? They want to look at this Botox depression thing.
Huh.
So March 26, American Academy of Dermatology annual meeting, they presented their results. 24 weeks, they randomized. They said double blind. Double blind means nobody, neither the treating physician or the person knows if they're getting Botox, but that's ridiculous. If you get Botox injected, you know it because you can't move the muscle that it's injected into. So
yeah, placebo would be very hard to fake.
That's right. 24 weeks, 30 people in it, and they had some that started off on placebo and switched to Botox, some that started off on Botox and switched over to placebo, and they evaluated them during the 24-week period of the trial. There was significant improvement in both groups. The ones that started on Botox, the cosmetic effects wore off between weeks 12 and 16. You know, and I know nothing about Botox, but I was a little surprised you could an injection would last 12 to 16 weeks. That's a long time. But the improvement in depression was maintained for the full 24 weeks. So even after they regained the ability to frown, essentially, they were still not depressed. Now, one possibility, if you smile more and frown less, you have better social experiences. I smile at you, you smile back. It's all, again, it's back to being married. It's like we are married because we're both smiling at each other.
Not now, though.
Yeah. But, well, Rick's frowning at me right now. He'll whip out the Botox and we'll take care of that.
Yeah, yeah.
The other possibility, and this is the psychiatrist feels, is maybe when you are unable to make an angry facial expression, there is less activity in a part of your brain called the amygdala. And, again, your trigeminal nerve connects the two. So maybe we can affect your brain by paralyzing your frown muscles.
Nice.
And it feeds back to your brain. That's one thought. But, again, a small study. Botox not approved for treatment of depression. Probably won't be based on this study. But isn't it fascinating? The anxiety medicines increase your risk of dying. Marriage decreases your risk of heart disease. And Botox, at least in a small study, if you can't frown, you apparently don't get depressed.
Hmm. So if we remove frowns, we don't get depressed. That's all we try to do in this show is to remove frowns.
Well, how about if we remove ourselves from the show? Can you get us off the air, Rick?
Pretty sure I can handle that. Special thanks to Morehead State Public Radio producers Asa Hosoda and Spencer Johnson, to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, we pledge that no UK basketball players were harmed in the making of our show. Also, remember this important information.
Health Matters may cause serious side effects that can be life-threatening. Call your doctor or get medical help right away if you have any of these problems anytime, even weeks after listening to our show.
Problems swallowing, speaking, breathing due to weakening of the muscles can be severe and result in loss of life. You are at highest risk if you had these problems before the show. You may have problems swallowing Health Matters for several months.
As we do.
Yes. Also, tell your doctor about muscle or nerve conditions. You need to tell your doctor if you have amyotrophic lateral sclerosis or Lou Gehrig's disease, myasthenia gravis, or Lambert-Eaton syndrome, as you may be at increased risk of serious side effects, including severe dysphagia or difficulty swallowing, and respiratory compromise from listening to Health Matters.
Spread of toxic effects. The effects of Health Matters may spread beyond your ears and cause serious symptoms including muscle weakness and loss of strength, double vision and drooping eyelids, hoarseness or loss of voice, maybe not Tony's, trouble saying words clearly, more like Rick, or loss of bladder control, well, never mind. If this happens, do not drive a car, operate machinery, a microphone, or do other dangerous activities.
That's right. Health Matters is advising you, if you lose your bladder control, do not drive a car. And that is darn good advice, I gotta say, Rick. There's not been a confirmed case of spread of toxic effects away from the ears when Health Matters has been used at the recommended dose. Whatever you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for our exciting series on the health benefits of procrastination on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. Additional information available online at neahec.org.